Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Armed Career Criminal Act and Sentencing Guidelines Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On November 28, 2016, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Beckles v. United States. Travis Beckles, who had previous felony convictions, mostly for drug possession and sales, was an armed career criminal under the Armed Career Criminal Act and was therefore convicted in district court and subject to sentencing enhancement under the sentencing guidelines after being found in possession of a firearm. Pursuant to the sentencing guidelines, Beckles was eligible for a sentence range from 360 months to life imprisonment, and the court sentenced him to 360 months in prison, 5 months of supervised release, and a $5,000 fine. Beckles appealed and argued that the sentencing guidelines imposed an unreasonable sentence, that his prior convictions did not qualify as violent felonies, subject to sentencing enhancement under ACCA, and that possession of a sawed-off shotgun was not a crime of violence, subject to sentencing enhancement under the sentencing guidelines. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit affirmed his conviction and sentence. The U.S. Supreme Court vacated the appellate court's decision and remanded the case for reconsideration in light of Johnson v. United States, which determined that the residual clause of ACCA was unconstitutional. On remand, the appellate court again upheld Beckles' conviction and sentence. The appellate court also held that the Johnson decision did not affect this case because Beckles was not sentenced under the residual clause of ACCA, but rather under express language from the sentencing guidelines about sentencing enhancements for crimes of violence. The three questions now before the Supreme Court are: 1. Whether Johnson v. United States applies retroactively to collateral cases challenging federal sentences enhanced under the residual clause in United States Sentencing Guidelines, Section 4B1.2A2. 2. Whether Johnson's constitutional holding applies to the residual clause in USSG Section 4B1.2A2, thereby rendering challenges to sentences enhanced under it cognizable on collateral review. And 3. Whether mere possession of a sawed-off shotgun, an offense listed as a crime of violence only in commentary to USSG Section 4B1.2, remains a crime of violence after Johnson. To discuss the case, we have Carissa Hessick, who is the Anne Shea Ransdell and William Garland Buck Ransdell Jr. Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of North Carolina School of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Hessick.
The U.S. Supreme Court heard argument on November 28th in Beckles versus United States. There were three questions presented in Beckles. First, whether a federal sentencing guideline is unconstitutionally vague. Second, if the guideline is vague, whether a ruling to that effect would be retroactive under the Teague framework. That is, whether defendants who were previously sentenced under the guidelines could still receive new sentences. And third, whether an official policy statement by the U.S. Sentencing Commission about how to interpret a vague guideline can cure any vagueness problems. Now, as a general matter, criminal laws have to be precise when they define what conduct is prohibited and when they set the punishment for engaging in that conduct. Beckles asks whether a federal sentencing guideline, a guideline that's commonly referred to as the career offender guideline, is precise enough to satisfy the Constitution. Now, the career offender guideline includes language that the Supreme Court already said was unconstitutionally vague when it appeared in a law that set mandatory minimum sentences. The Supreme Court ruled this way in 2015 in a case called Johnson. Now, Beckles raises the question whether the same vagueness rules apply to the federal sentencing guidelines as the rules that apply to statutes. The federal sentencing guidelines only advise judges about appropriate sentences. They don't set mandatory minimum sentences. Beckles is an important case because of the number of people it affects and the possible changes it'll make to federal law. Thousands of defendants have been sentenced under the career offender guideline, and when the Supreme Court said that this same language was unconstitutionally vague in Johnson, it later made that ruling retroactive. So that is to say, it later held that defendants who'd previously been sentenced under that law and who'd already finished their appeals could nonetheless request a new sentencing. It's relatively rare for the Supreme Court to say that one of its rulings is retroactive, and so Beckles can be an important and unusual case in this respect. Now, in answering the question whether the same vagueness rules apply to the federal sentencing guidelines, and whether the same retroactivity rules apply to the federal sentencing guidelines. The Supreme Court may have to clarify the legal status of the federal sentencing guidelines. The legal status of the guidelines has been in flux since 2005, when the Supreme Court decided a major case called United States versus Booker, in which it said that the guidelines have to be treated as advisory rather than mandatory. Now, the legal status of the guidelines is an important and complicated question. The Supreme Court has heard many, many cases on this issue. The guidelines form the basis of sentencing for all federal criminal defendants, and every time the Supreme Court decides a case that clarifies their legal status, it causes reverberations in the lower courts for years afterwards. So that's sort of an introduction to Beckles. Let me now talk a little bit about the argument. Because Beckles involved three separate questions, the oral argument had a really interesting dynamic. It wasn't the typical argument where the government argues on one side and the defendant argues on the other. The government in this case actually agreed with the defendant about one of the questions. Specifically, the United States and the defendant agreed that the career offender guideline is unconstitutionally vague and that defendants should be permitted to raise vagueness challenges to the federal sentencing guidelines. But the government and the defendant disagreed about the retroactivity question and about whether the commission's official commentary cures the vagueness problem. Now, because the lower court in Beckles, the 11th Circuit, had said that the vagueness doctrine doesn't apply at all to the federal sentencing guidelines, the Supreme Court appointed an amicus to argue in support of the judgment below. Specifically, they appointed a very respected lawyer from Chicago, Adam Mortara, to argue that issue. So there were three different lawyers who argued rather than just two. And I'll add that Mr. Mortara, probably because he was an amicus rather than a repeat player, took some really aggressive, interesting, and very principled opinions that are very skeptical of the current legal status of the federal sentencing guidelines, so the all of the cases that the Supreme Court's been deciding since Booker. Now, I'll add, I think that the oral argument laid bare some of the paradoxes of modern Supreme Court sentencing doctrine. As I mentioned, Booker versus United States said that the federal sentencing guidelines have to be treated as advisory. Cases prior to Booker had held that mandatory sentencing guidelines create a Sixth Amendment problem every time you limit a judge's ability to impose a particular sentence, and yet you have a law that says that punishments need to get increased for particular sentences. The Supreme Court said it's no difference in creating a new crime, and those facts are just like elements that need to be submitted to a jury and proven beyond a reasonable doubt. In Booker, the Supreme Court applied that rule from previous cases to the federal sentencing guidelines, but rather than telling federal courts that they had to start submitting facts under the federal sentencing guidelines to a jury, instead, five justices decided to make the guidelines advisory. So if judges no longer have to follow the guidelines, then perhaps they don't run afoul of the Sixth Amendment. You see, the Sixth Amendment sentencing cases that preceded Booker all had to acknowledge that fact-finding in the aid of broad judicial discretion was okay. After all, you know, guidelines were a relatively recent invention, and a system without guidelines that just sort of let judges find facts and make their own sentencing judgments had been the dominant sentencing system in the many decades before the adoption of federal sentencing guidelines and other similar structured sentencing systems. So I'll say, at the time that Booker was decided, no one really knew what it meant to have an advisory system. Several states had purely voluntary guidelines, and at least some people thought that maybe in a post-Booker world, the federal sentencing guidelines might be purely voluntary. But the cases decided since Booker have made clear that that's not the case. You know, the guidelines maybe aren't all that advisory. They might not be mandatory, but they're definitely, as a legal matter, more than advice to judges. Judges are required to find facts necessary to calculate the guideline range, and although they can impose a non-guideline sentence, there's confusion in the lower courts about exactly how far that authority extends. A number of circuits, including the 11th Circuit, have pushed back on the idea that district court judges can impose a non-guideline sentence based only on a policy disagreement, and even if a district court judge is permitted to sentence outside of the guideline range, sentences are subject to review on appeal, a number of circuits presume that sentences within the guidelines are necessarily reasonable, so they'll necessarily affirm them. And all of the circuits use the guideline twice in appellate review of lower court sentences, once as a procedural check to make sure that the district court judge did calculate the guidelines and calculated the guidelines range appropriately, and then once as a substantive check while they assess whether it was an appropriate sentence in light of a number of things, including how far the judge decided to sentence outside of the guidelines. Now, it's because the guidelines continue to play such a significant role at sentencing that the Office of the Solicitor General, the government, argued that the guidelines are subject to a vagueness challenge. Deputy Solicitor General Michael Dreeben did a really fantastic job in his argument explaining this middle path that the court has carved for the guidelines since Booker. They're not mandatory, but nor are they completely voluntary. You know, he described a number of aspects of the guidelines, the anchoring effect that they have, and also the procedural mechanisms that the court has used to reinforce the primacy of the guidelines. And he had a particularly great quote saying that the current advisory system, quote, injects law into the sentencing process. Now, as the Beckles argument illustrates, the middle path the court has carved is complicated. The court continues to struggle with how to regulate an advisory system in light of the fact that the purely discretionary system that the federal sentencing guidelines replaced was essentially unregulated. You know, counsel for Beckles spent much of her argument fending off questions by various justices about how a guideline could be unconstitutionally vague if a purely discretionary system that gives no guidance at all to judges is permissible under the Constitution. Justices Alito, Breyer, Kennedy, and Chief Justice Roberts all asked questions to this effect. So it's worth noting that later questions by Justice Breyer and the Chief Justice appeared to accept that a purely discretionary system might be subject to different rules than an advisory system, though one wonders whether they're necessarily going to arrive at that ultimate decision. So the complexity of the middle path was on full display at the Beckles argument, in part because the United States relied on that complexity to take what Justice Kennedy and what the court-appointed amicus characterized as inconsistent positions, right? The U.S. argued that advisory guidelines are subject to vagueness challenges because of the important role that they play, but they argued that the advisory status of the guidelines should prevent the court from making any vagueness ruling retroactive. The government distinguished the Beckles case both from the decision to make the original Johnson ruling about mandatory minimum laws retroactive and a very recent case about juvenile life without parole decisions. The government distinguished Beckles from life without parole cases by saying that under the court's new rule in juvenile life without parole cases, you have to have a particular finding in order for a defendant to be eligible for a life without parole sentence. And in contrast, according to the government, the guidelines affect only the likelihood that a defendant will receive a particular sentence. Now, the government relied on this distinction between the likelihood of a sentence and eligibility for a sentence as the reason it took different positions on the vagueness question and the retroactivity question. And while Justice Sotomayor pressed the government on this distinction, none of the attorneys or the justices mentioned what I think is a very important fact about this case. When Beckles was sentenced in a Florida district court, the prevailing law in the 11th Circuit actually required a finding in order for Beckles to be eligible for some lower sentence. I'll say I don't think that the petitioner had much time in her rebuttal to do much other than give a very broad overview of her argument. And this particular argument about how the law of different circuits actually constrains district court judges was something that I'd written in an amicus brief. I suppose I should mention I submitted an amicus brief on behalf of a number of law professors about many of the issues resolved in this case. In any event, let me say that there were other really odd aspects of the Supreme Court's post-Booker sentencing doctrine on display. Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito raised the question whether the court's recent decisions about the quasi-legal status of the advisory guidelines should continue if sentencing patterns change. And maybe because this area of law is so complex, Justice Ginsburg and Justice Kennedy appeared to sort of cast about for an easy way to dispose of the case In particular, they both raised the possibility of simply deciding this on the basis of the Sentencing Commission's policy statement. At one point, Justice Ginsburg said, basically, "I thought if we decide this issue, the case is over. And so, well, I was thinking we could decide the issue and not reach either the vagueness or the retroactivity issue." Now, I'll say to his credit, Deputy Solicitor General Dreeben discouraged the court from taking that path, even though it would have meant a victory for the government. You know, he noted that there are many cases that raise the vagueness and retroactivity questions that are currently pending in the lower courts that aren't solved by this particular piece of the guidelines commentary. I'll also add that deciding the case on the ground of the commentary gets into some tricky administrative law waters. U.S. Sentencing Commission policy statements don't have to go through any sort of congressional disapproval process. And in fact, this particular policy statement didn't. And so deciding this case on the basis of the policy statement would raise questions of allowing agencies to promulgate vague guidelines or vague regulations, I suppose more generally, and then leaving to themselves room to resolve ambiguity in their own favor with later interpretations. Right? Deference to agencies on interpretations of their own regulation is something that the Supreme Court has permitted in the past in a case called Auer, so this is often called Auer deference. But there's been some rumbling by a few lower courts and a couple of justices to revisit whether that deference is appropriate, and this seems like a sort of odd vehicle in which to confront that issue. In any event, I'll say it's hard to read the transcript of the Beckles argument and think that the defendant is likely to prevail on all three of the questions presented. Only just Justice Sotomayor seemed to be asking friendly questions of petitioner's counsel, and only she seemed to resist the government's likelihood versus eligibility argument. Even if Beckles doesn't prevail, though, we may end up seeing another vagueness challenge to the guidelines in the not-so-distant future, and that's because the Supreme Court has another vagueness case on its docket, Lynch versus DiMaia, which involves whether a different federal statute is unconstitutionally vague. That language from that separate statute has been incorporated into another guideline. And although the U.S. Sentencing Commission has amended both the career offender guidelines, so the guideline from Beckles, and this other guideline, the guideline that incorporates the language that's at issue in DiMaia, that doesn't necessarily mean that there won't be the need for the court to take another guidelines vagueness case. That's because, as the Supreme Court decided several terms ago, the ex post facto prohibition now applies to the U.S. sentencing guidelines. So a whole bunch of defendants will be allowed to claim a right to be sentenced under these old guidelines if their relevant conduct occurred before the commission change took effect. So even though they might be arrested or convicted far later in time, they nonetheless may be raising fresh issues of vagueness to these guidelines, even though the guidelines have been amended. So that's Beckles versus United States for you, a complicated technical case that could affect many, many criminal defendants, but could also represent another turning point in the Supreme Court's clarification of what precisely needs to happen now with the federal sentencing guidelines in this ongoing question of how to handle so-called advisory sentencing guidelines.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.